listeners. I'm Carla Golden, back from a combination of too much lab work and a lovely vacation, and I'm here with Ethan McCurdy. We are Top of the Noggin, that is N-O-G-N, which stands for Neuroscience Outreach Group at NYU, and we're bringing you the latest and most exciting breakthroughs in neuroscience, with an emphasis on new studies, cutting-edge technology, and neuroscience and culture. Today, we're going to go over a paper published in eLife in February 2019, titled The Cellular Basis of Mechanosensory Merkel Cell Innervation During Development. As always, be sure to stick around for when we bring in the first author for some Q&A later on in the show. This time, we'll be speaking with Blair Jenkins.
Think about your sense of touch for a moment. You're probably thinking about your skin, which you use to feel the world around you. But how does your skin sense something? It's actually not your skin cells that do the feeling. Instead, embedded in your skin are neurons that are specially designed to feel. These neurons are called sensory neurons because they carry sensory information about touch to your brain. They take physical, mechanical information, like a light breeze passing over your skin, and translate it into the currency that your neurons can understand, that is, electrical activity. They do this by expressing receptors that get stimulated when they interact with the outside world that then activate the neurons. Once the light breeze gets communicated to your brain, you might develop goosebumps. These neurons in the skin are also able to sense a wide variety of information, like the texture of a rough shirt or a hug from a close friend. They are therefore helpful for navigating the world and can be absolutely critical during developmental windows, like when babies need nurturing attention from their caregivers to develop key cognitive and social behaviors.
One type of touch or sensory receptor is the Merkel cell neurite complex. That's a mouthful, so let's break that down. Merkel cells are specialized skin cells that were discovered by F.S. Merkel in 1875. And are so named after him, that form a complex with sensory neurons. These complexes are found in areas of the skin that are particularly sensitive, such as the fingertips, or in areas of the skin that have hairs, like the skin on your arms. Think again of a breeze blowing past your arm and how your arm hairs bend in the wind when it does, causing you to feel a chill. You have your Merkel cell complexes to thank for that experience. Your hair follicles bump up against the Merkel cell neurite complexes, which then notify your brain that your hairs have been bent by an outside force. The spots where hair follicles bump up against the Merkel cell neurite complexes are called touchstones. This is a term we will use throughout the episode. Again, that's touchstones.
While Merkel cell complexes are known to be important for perceiving touch or other types of gentle pressure, we don't know how these complexes are formed in the first place. How are they dispatched to the specific areas that need them? When an organism is growing in the womb, what gives the signal that these complexes should develop in those particular areas? In this paper, Blair and her colleagues examined the touch receptor patterning of the touchstones using mouse models.
We should add that development generally refers to the time period in which the organism is growing. You may remember how Lucy Bix and her co-authors explored the effects of social isolation during development in a paper we covered a few episodes back. This is an enormously complex time biologically, making it difficult to study. Think about it. Entire organ systems like cardiac or pulmonary structures are being built from just a few germ layers. Cellular precursors are differentiating into specialized cell types on an immense biological scale across the entire body. And, of particular interest to neuroscientists, billions of neurons are deciphering both competing and cooperative cues, traversing great lengths to find their eventual targets, like other neurons or specific tissues to innervate, like the skin.
In this paper, Blair and her colleagues examined the development of sensory neurons that surround hair follicles in developing embryos. They asked whether touchstones, these structures that contain Merkel cells in hair follicles, co-opt signaling pathways of specialized skin cells in order to create patterns of touch receptors in the right place at the right time. They found that indeed, a particular type of epithelial skin cell is crucial for the pattern of neural development of touchstones during embryonic development. So, how did they do this?
Blair and her colleagues started off by searching for particular skin cell clusters that would mark the spot where touch domes would develop. They first looked at a marker that labels embryonic structures called placodes, which give rise to hair follicles, to see if they also identify where touch domes would appear. They also looked at a marker expressed by Merkel cells. Indeed, when mice were mere embryos, the authors found that both markers did associate with each other during development, and that the marker expressed by Merkel cells appeared to label nascent touch domes. In fact, as the embryonic mice developed, the number of Merkel cells labeled by the Merkel cell marker steadily increased in touch domes until this population was markedly enriched in the touch domes and located just above the primary hair follicles, 16.5 days into embryonic development. To summarize, nascent touch domes, marked by the presence of Merkel cell and placode labels, appear just above primary follicles by the 16th day of embryonic development.
It was known to the authors that the embryonic structures that produce hair follicles often crop up next to groups of specialized cells that secrete a protein called BMP4, which helps control hair follicle growth. Using transgenic animals to illuminate dermal cells that express BMP4, the authors identified a previously undiscovered population of mesenchymal cells, a type of stem cell, expressing BMP4. That formed co-clusters with the developing touch domes next to the hair follicles. Since the touch domes and BMP4 expressing populations form co-clusters, the authors asked what would happen if they shut down BMP4 signaling. Would the touch domes still form next to the hair follicles? To inhibit the BMP4 signaling pathways, the authors induced the expression of noggin, which inactivates BMP4. That is N-O-G-G-I-N, not the acronym for outreach group.
When the authors did this, both before and after the 16th day of embryonic development, the primary hair follicles still developed normally. However, the development of the touch dome was dramatically impaired when BMP4 signaling was inhibited before embryonic day 16.5. When the signaling was inhibited after this window, the touch dome's area did not deviate from controls, perhaps owing to the fact that Merkel cells had apparently already migrated from the follicle to the touch dome.
At this point, the authors had gained a clearer understanding of the molecular signaling underlying the temporal dynamics between the patterning of touch domes abutting the primary hair follicles. They next wondered when these Merkel cell-containing structures were being innervated by sensory neurons that projected to the skin cells. The authors labeled Merkel cells and sensory afferent neurons with immunofluorescent stainings. They found that 16.5 days into development, sensory neuron branches penetrated the epidermis and made first contact with the Merkel cells. As the embryonic stages progressed, including through early postnatal stages, the sensory neurons densely innervated the touch dome structures and extended numerous branches into Merkel cell clusters. Think of these immunofluorescent stainings of neurons innervating the touch dome as watching a root system of a houseplant grow extensively within a clay pot.
Interestingly, upon further investigation, Claire and her colleagues found that there were actually two distinct neuronal populations that innervated touch domes. One population whose nerve endings terminated onto Merkel cells, and another whose endings went beyond the Merkel cell clusters and terminated in the granular layers of the touch dome. One population develops transiently during development, and the other persists into adulthood.
Finally, the authors characterized the lineage of skin cells that are required for patterning touch dome afferents during development. They did this using a tamoxifen-induced mouse model to ablate touch dome skin cells at a time point during embryogenesis following the development of the hair follicle. After confirming the touch dome was disrupted, Blair and her colleagues observed fewer Merkel cells and a significant reduction in the median number of neurofilament-positive afferent nerve endings.
The authors were able to reverse the reduced innervation at early postnatal stages by driving the overexpression of a signaling protein that induces the expansion of skin cells expressing the placode marker without altering Merkel cell numbers. Upon expanding these skin cells in postnatal animals, the authors observed an increase in skin innervation, suggesting that skin cells expressing the placode marker are responsible for recruiting sensory innervation of the touch domes and not Merkel cells.
Altogether, the authors found a novel population of BMP4 expressing cells that appears to be required for touch dome development, but not hair follicle development, at a critical window during embryogenesis. They identified two populations of sensory neurons that target touch domes, one of which persists throughout development. And finally, they found a population of skin cells that is necessary to establish touch dome innervation patterns during development. In conclusion, Blair and her colleagues illuminated a novel signaling and temporal sequence of mechanosensory development during embryogenesis. All right, everyone, we're now joined by Blair Jenkins. Blair is a current internal medicine resident at Greenwich Hospital. She conducted her undergraduate studies at Yale and graduated from Columbia University Irving Medical Center with both her MD and PhD, performing the graduate portion of her studies in the laboratory of Dr. Alan Lumpkin. Blair was the 2018 recipient of the Kavli Award for Distinguished Research in Neuroscience, and for years, she helped lead numerous scientific outreach programs with the Columbia University Neuroscience Organization. Blair, it is such an honor to have you on today. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Ethan. It's a pleasure to be on the show. Really excited.
Thank you so much for coming on. So since you studied development, our first question for you is about your development and your science trajectory. What is your scientific background, and what led you to doing an MD PhD at Columbia, and how did that get you to where you are today?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I first became passionate about science as a very young person. I'm sure a lot of us did. I think seventh grade, when we did our fetal pig dissection, was when I first realized I was infatuated with anatomy and how small organisms become big organisms, and that really started planting the seed for me in terms of wanting to go into either science or medicine. And then when I started at Yale in my freshman year, I took a course on sort of mind, brain, and behavior that was an intro level course, but really spanned from basic mechanisms of neuroscience all the way to cognitive neurosciences, and was a really great primer to all the vast different things one can study in neuroscience. And that set in motion the wheels for wanting to do something related to the brain and sensory experience, and sort of understanding that, or how we take in information all day long, process it, and how it drives and kind of determines our behavior. So that's really broad strokes. I ended up in college joining a lab that studied brain development. So that was in line with my fetal pig early days. But at the time, the lab was studying branching, how Purkinje neurons get their beautiful branched trees. And I was doing confocal imaging at a time when it was still kind of new, and immunohistochemistry, and really liked that aspect, sort of being able to see on the slide right in front of your eyes, like, here's a structure that starts from, like, we all start from like two cells, and somehow you get this beautiful tree-shaped thing, and that really amazed me. I took sort of a little sidetrack, and I was finishing up at Yale and realized I sort of had several conflicting career path options in mind. I really liked science. I also was starting to like medicine. I'd done some hospital work as a volunteer and shadowing doctors, and I liked that aspect of getting to work with patients. And I also really liked science education. I kind of had all these different hats and things I was doing in college, as many college students do, and decided to actually take a little bit of a break and teach. So I did Teach for America for 2 years and tried to use that time, although it wasn't really much of a break. I ended up being very busy, but I was hoping to use that time to think of, should I go medicine or should I go PhD? Like, which one should I do? And in the course of those 2 years, I ended up talking to mentors who said, you know, there's a thing called an MD PhD where you can do both, and you can just delay that whole thought process until the end of your 8 or 9 year period of schooling. And to me, that was really attractive because I got that, I felt like at the end of an MD PhD, I probably would get to do some science, a lot of medicine, and also a lot of teaching. A lot, you know, MD PhDs end up being academics usually. Kind of a goal. So embarked on that path, applied to Columbia. What really attracted me to Columbia was, you know, it's a great, there's a lot of really amazing sensory neuroscientists there, there are people there who I had sort of, I'd read their work as a student, and I kind of just knew, like, you know, the Eric Kendall, like that whole name sort of came to mind when I thought of where do I want to be, where do I want to go. I really wanted to live in New York. And the medical school is amazing. So I applied broadly and ended up choosing Columbia. But then choosing Merkel cells is kind of that's where things get kind of interesting in terms of how I ended up there. At some point along the line, I realized I have this passion for neuroscience. It's always been there. But I also kind of am interested in skin. And I don't know where that came from. I think just being in clinic and realizing how many diseases manifest in skin and can come back to skin, and how you can, there's sort of a Halcyon way that derms can kind of look at skin and be like, this is what the person has. And everyone else is like, oh my God, like, how did you diagnose that just based on that one spot? And so that started just in the first weeks of doing clinical rotations, that are already starting to be something like, oh, I kind of want to do that, but how do I marry these two things? And then boom, like, okay, sensory neuroscience, skin, touch. Like, touch is an area of sensory neuroscience we know very little about. The neurons that mediate touch are embedded in skin. We don't really know a lot about skin, how it develops, how it functions on a basic level. So it all sort of made sense. And then it serendipitously ran into Ellen Lumpkin at the first year retreat of neuroscience. And it was just like explosive, because everything that I was already, they were starting to brew, came to light, and everything she was saying. And it just was like, this is the person I was meant to find this person. She's awesome. So that's how I ended up in her lab. And I hope it makes sense now, sort of how I ended up doing a development project that's always been an interest of mine. And we still know very little about how the sensory nervous system of skin is established early on. There's a lot of work that's done in adult mice, because we can do recordings very easily in adult mice. But how you get, you know, 17 and counting different types of neurons that all seem to somehow developmentally find different areas of skin throughout development and serve very different functions has been an open question for a really long time. And it turns out a great way of studying it is confocal microscopy and chemistry, things today. So it all comes together. It's funny how in hindsight, like in the moment of all those steps, it feels like, oh my gosh, I don't know what I'm doing. But when you look back, I think that's a really common experience, that you realize like there actually has been a really common thread in everything I've done and everything I want to do.
And it's very cool that you have such a clear like through line, even from like having those experiences, like the way that you got excited by science was this like tangible experience of like holding brains or like seeing cells. And then that's, you know, part of education is trying to give these like tangible ways of like making neuroscience accessible to students. Yeah, I mean, I think it sounds like you followed your passions and that's how it became this one clear.
Yep. That's the one pearl I would have, is that as long as you go towards things that get your skin tingling, not to be cheesy, but like really, like you kind of get you'll get a feeling when you're doing work that makes you excited and feels right, and just kind of go with that. I think that's good advice for young scientists who are still getting started.
Yeah, listeners, that's from an expert. And
yes.
Diving into your paper, you study this temporal sequence of development. The hair follicle forms, the touch domes appear next to it, and the touch dome is innervated. Could you break down this developmental process and describe what you observed?
Yes. So just to give a little bit of background, so in mice, and we think possibly also in humans, skin develops first in layers from deep to superficial. So first you get the dermis, which is this fibroblast-rich, collagen-dense, very stretchy layer of skin. That's actually the layer of skin that gives it its tensile properties and makes it like so that you can pinch it, and it gives it that kind of, that's the meat of skin. And then on top of that, there's a layer of keratinocytes. It's pretty flimsy and thin, actually. It doesn't have a lot of integrity to it. But that's important for barrier function and actually keeping all of your water and moisture inside and bathing your organs and not floating to the outside. So that those two layers kind of grow first. You get the dermis, and then the layers of keratinocytes kind of layer and layer and layer on top of one another until you have a layer that's roughly 4 or 5 cell layers deep on top of the dermis. That happens really early. In mice, it starts happening, so a gestational period is about 20 days. You start seeing these layers forming very early on, E12, E13. And then the next step that starts happening, I mean, if you think of skin and what's in, if you look at it and it seems it's like, okay, it's just skin, that's all there is these two layers. But actually there are sweat glands and hair follicles and, accessory muscles that help raise up the hair follicles when you get goosebumps. And there's oil glands. There's actually a lot of different pieces that are embedded in the skin, and those all have to develop as well after you get the stratification of those layers. So in mice, this is actually very cool. It's very coordinated, and it all that process starts. You get the accessory, those extra pieces growing on the face, and then it progresses down the back into the tail. And it's very coordinated. I'm sure there are a lot of clock genes that mediate this. I didn't really get into those, but it's a very stereotyped process, and it happens in a very stereotyped way. And we know a lot about hair follicle development because that whole process has been studied for many, many decades in mice, sort of this wave-like progression of hair follicle development. But what wasn't really known before I started working in the lab is how do touch domes fit into that? So touch domes are raised areas of skin that contain Merkel cells, which are sensory cells that connect to a special sensory neuron and help mediate gentle touch. Think of touch domes as sort of right now what they're doing for us is kind of giving us the sense that we have a shirt on, if that makes sense. It's just giving you a sense of that gentle touch, and you kind of forget about it, but it's always there. They're always working. That's what they're doing on the body. And so how they get there, the timing of that, what molecules mediate it, how it relates to hair follicle development and the development of other structures was really kind of unclear in the literature prior to my body of work. And so it was really important to figure out, does the hair follicle come first, or does the touch dome come first, or do they pop up at the same time? And so I did a lot of time courses early on in my PhD to look at skin at various body sites over time and see, okay, we know there's this wave of hair follicle development, but what are touch domes doing in relation to that? And we found that essentially the hair follicle seems to come first, and then touch domes develop in a very similar wave-like pattern going down the back, always in concert with the development of each hair follicle. So what that suggests is that it's a similar set of factors that build hair follicles, similar morphogens, BMPs, FGFs, Sonic Hedgehog, are probably doing the same thing in the touch dome just like a few hours later, but it's always adjacent to a follicle and it seems to follow in that same wave-like pattern.
Since you're looking at the E16.5, this kind of crucial time point, yeah. Was there a particular area along the back that you kept going to look at this developmental process?
Yeah, so I tried to focus on between the scapula because I didn't want to be on the head. If you think about a mouse embryo, their head and neck blend very evenly with the back and very smoothly. And so I tried to really stay between the scapula, if that makes sense, and try to be consistent because I knew about this wave and that if you sampled from the upper back on one mouse and the lower back on another mouse at different time points, that would throw off the data. So I really tried to be consistent and focus on the upper back region. So, and that also would be helful for the assay, the tools that I would need to study the electrophysiology of this system haven't been developed yet, but I was thinking it'd be nice to know like specifically where I was looking in case someone were to try to record from the same neurons at the same developmental time points. Or if you were going to look, you know, at the lower part of the back, then you would know to just look a day later or something like that. You might be able to find touch domes there. So I thought that was really important actually to remain consistent when I was doing my experiments.
We make a, in the introduction, we made this point about how complex the task is for the developmental biologist to study these processes because of the whirlwind of signaling pathways that are ongoing at the time.
Yes, that is a very difficult aspect, especially when you get into trying to disrupt signaling pathways and look at the effects, because invariably you find that there's never a clean experiment. So it does make it quite challenging. And I think the best developmental neurobiologists find ways, you know, find resources and have, it takes a long time, but they find ways to block multiple pathways at once or an entire class of receptors at a time to try to really get at what's this one molecule doing. It's very, very challenging.
So here's I've got a question for you. It's scaling up away from the molecular pathway, I think. And it's just that, why are Merkel cells important? And in that context, it's because you found this population of keratinocytes that are recruiting the sensory innervation of the touch domes. So if you could recapitulate that, would Merkel cells be needed at all?
This is a very good question that I get asked a lot at meetings. So taking just a step back, so in adult skin, what we know about the role of Merkel cells in this structure, the Merkel cell neurite complex. So with Merkel cell and the neuron together, and we look at the electrophysiology data in adults, what we find is that Merkel cells are critical for the sustained response of that neuron. The neuron all by itself can actually respond to dynamic changes in sensation. So a great way that Dr. Lumpkin kind of explained this to me, and I always say it to others, is if you are wearing jeans right now or some kind of like slightly textured pants and you sort of like move your fingertips across the pants, hopefully you'll find is that as you move, you're able to sense texture and that your jeans aren't actually totally smooth. There are ridges, but hopefully you can appreciate that you actually have to move your fingertip pads around to really get a sense of the texture. If you just rest them, it's actually quite hard to sense the texture of something, but you know that you're pressing on something. So if you break that down, the texture sensation, the neuron itself can do that. You can knock out Merkel cells or have a mouse model where Merkel cells never develop, and they can still do that dynamic texture sensing role. That's totally intact. But what they lack is the ability to have that sustained pressure response. So to like know over long periods of time, I'm touching my genes. You need the Merkel cells to kind of keep the neuronal response going and going and going. Actually, someone in the lab recorded a Merkel cell neurite complex that he wanted to just know how long they could fire for, and he left the little stimulator probe on the skin, and it was like 30 minutes later, it was still firing. So they're very reliable, and the Merkel cells are kind of really helping keep the firing going. If you don't have them, the neuron will kind of fire, and then stop. So we know that that's true in adult skin. We don't know yet functionally in developing skin what they do. And as you said very astutely, they don't seem to be required for development at all. We looked in the knockout, the animal that lacks Merkel cell development, and the neurons innervate touch domes just fine in the absence of Merkel cells. So they're not, this was actually really surprising to me, they're not secreting any factors or cues that are required for touch dome innervation. I do think it's actually those other cells that we found in the touch dome that are possibly driving that process, because when we ablate those, you get aberrant development. So I have this kind of speculation that Merkel cells may function early as kind of the only thing the embryo has to sense, like to have tactile sensation on the surface of their skin. They don't have hair. Hair hasn't developed fully yet. Those neurons that wrap around the hairs haven't developed. But if you poke an embryo, if you've ever seen quickening in a pregnant mom, like, I don't know, what's the word? Like, not embryos, fetuses, I guess. Can you say fetuses? Unborn babies inside of mom's belly are very exquisitely touch sensitive. So I have this thought that perhaps you want to get those Merkel cells out there early and in the touch domes early and wired up nice and early, because before you have hair, that's all you really have to sense your environment and feel fluid movement around you and know that your twin brother is next to you or whatever. Does that make sense? Did that make any sense? Let me know if I can say it. I can say that again.
Unless you're breaking it, I needed it.
Okay.
Okay. I was feeling my jeans while you're talking about it.
Is that too sensual, or I don't know?
Hey, it's starting also with audio podcast. Yep. Yeah, that was a great experiential learning for me.
Cool.
So right now you're not in the lab anymore, right? You are working as a doctor. You're doing your residency. How has your experience in the lab translated to what you're doing in the clinic?
So for me, because my research was so basic, there aren't a lot of direct applications to clinical work. You know, if I had done more translational work, I'm sure there would be perhaps more ways in which I can apply directly what I had done in the lab to my clinical experience now. But I think in a much more general sense, a lot of medicine is laboratory-based and imaging-based. You know, every day you're looking at or performing your own ultrasound of, you know, examination of a patient, or you're scrolling through head CTs. And so, like, I found that having a background in image, like doing confocal microscopy and dabbling in other types of microscopy, has been really helpful for just, for me, those things come so easily because it's the spatial, the sense of spatial orientation of objects in 3D when you're looking at 2D images and scanning through them is second nature, because for many years, that's all I did was look at images and scroll through them and analyze them and look for, oh, is that something there? Like, I did a lot of that. So I find that when I'm in the clinical setting, a lot of times my colleagues are like, oh, let's wait for the radiology read, or let's, and I'm like, no, let's open the image ourselves. Let's really look at it, because we might see something interesting. And that's been really exciting, because I do find that if you do imaging in the lab, it's second nature. Same with ultrasound. That's a very hot thing right now in medicine, is point of care ultrasound. So when you're in the ED and the patient's in front of you and you don't know what's going on, you're going to do a physical exam and you're going to listen to their heart. But what's even better is if you slap an ultrasound on their heart, you can see all the valves. You can see how well it's squeezing. You can see the outflow tract if it's dilated. And that, getting a grasp of how to do that and how to interpret what you're seeing, can be really hard if you haven't had to work with complex images before. So I find that those things come very naturally. And then just in general, a lot of medicine is very lab-based, actually. I put in a request to do a laboratory medicine elective, because I want to know more about, I want to see how the ELISAs are run and how the PCRs are done and how they test the sensitivities of the bacteria that we culture from our patients. Because, you know, behind the curtain of medicine, it's really run by a lab. Like, you have all of your tests are, and your clinical decision-making at the end of the day are driven by someone in a lab pipetting things and telling you if this is positive or negative. So I think no matter what you do your PhD in, if you're interested in medicine, there's going to be direct applications to what you're doing as a doctor if you have a laboratory background.
It's helpful as a doctor to, like, know what tools are available to you when making those diagnoses.
Yeah, and just also knowing, I mean, how fast should a PCR take? You know, like, it's little things like that that I've found that if you don't have a research background might seem very opaque to you.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm like, I'm going to call the lab today because I know that this PCR didn't take more than 2 days. You know, they probably did it and are just still analyzing the data or something. So let's follow up with that, because I know from doing tons of them myself that, you know, what it actually takes to do a PCR. It seems silly, but it's actually something that not everybody knows. So
yeah.
Actually, in the interest of, I'm going to run with the expression here of pulling back the curtain, having worn many different types of hat, like having worn many hats in your own career, would you have any career or industry advice that you could give us in general, or maybe just a good piece of advice that somebody gave you at some point along the line.
Yeah, I mean, I think following one's passion is big for me. Even if it takes you off a path that seems like the path that everyone else is taking, I think it's extremely valuable to, if something's calling you and it's, if there's some career path or experiment or really anything that just you can't get out, you go to bed at night and you just can't stop thinking about it, or you can't stop wondering, like, what would life be like if I did that, or if I cross those two mice together, like, I feel like you should just go ahead, and, like, obviously within reason, but go ahead and do that, because for me, that's been, I wouldn't do anything differently, but it's, you know, my path certainly hasn't been linear. The only thread has been that I've followed and tried to do things that interested me, and I think that's been, for me, that's been extremely successful, so I recommend that. I also think that if you're a scientist interested in medicine or vice versa, I think that there are a lot of ways that the two overlap that can not initially be so obvious or apparent, but there actually is a ton of crosstalk, and I think each side brings a lot to the other side of the table. And I guess this is most salient when I was, you know, I interviewed for dermatology, which is my specialty that I'll be going into ultimately, thinking, how am I going to pitch this, this, you know, neuroscience touch neuron background to a bunch of dermatologists? And it actually ended up being wildly successful because it's different, and the way that a neuroscientist thinks about biology is even vastly different from how a skin biologist thinks about biology. And it's amazing, actually, what can happen when you have melding of different minds, different ways of thinking, and the types of project ideas that came out of my interviews, because had such different worldviews coming together. It's really, really cool. So I think if you're hesitant about dabbling in something that's, you know, not necessarily science, and you're a scientist and you're interested in dabbling in medicine, or the other way around, I think definitely go for it, explore it, and you'd be surprised to see how much value that adds, having the other perspective.
I had a question that came to mind as we were talking about sort of like scientists and like personalities, and like, you'd like the type, like, who are you outside of the, well, I was going to say the lab, but outside of the hospital, like,
you know, outside of the hospital, I have many passions, which include cooking and taking care of my dog and kind of hanging out around the house. But one thing that certainly stands out for me is being, you know, an African-American woman in neuroscience, in medicine, in dermatology eventually. And fun fact, African-Americans are very poorly represented in dermatology. I think they represent 1 to 3% of all dermatologists in the U.S., which is wild to me. And I don't have the stats on hand for neuroscientists, but it's similarly low numbers. So I think as much as, you know, following my passion has been a common thread in my career path, that's also been an undercurrent. It's being part of a group that's underrepresented kind of at every stage of my training, and having to manage that everywhere from the microaggressive comments or just sort of feelings of self-doubt, imposter syndrome, all of that, that I think a lot of people experience in one way or another, depending on their background. Someone who's navigating the turbulent tides of academia, I think just as much as having diverse interests and backgrounds adds immensely to your science, to the way you view your patients, to the way you practice medicine, you know, in the sense that I was able to marry skin biology and neurobiology together and create something really cool. I think it's similarly, and I think just now becoming more appreciated, important to have people from different backgrounds, different perspectives, who've experienced the world in different ways throughout their childhood and adulthood. I think it's important to have all those different perspectives at the table, and contributing to the conversation, whatever conversation that may be, whether it's neuroscience or anything else, you know. I'm optimistic that in science, this is something that's being recognized. I was actually part of a fellowship program called the Neuroscience Scholars Program through the Society for Neuroscience that promotes underrepresented minorities in neuroscience. If anyone is interested, reach out to me on Twitter. It's a really great program that basically provides funding for you to go to conferences and also provides free access to SFN. I know with the virus now, conferences are kind of in a weird spot and mostly virtual, but I think should we resume having in-person conferences, and even in the virtual setting, having those, you know, access to funds to help fund your research, it's really great to have that as a resource. So I just wanted to put in a plug for that. And also just tell everybody, not to generalize, but a lot of us can feel, you know, anyone who's underrepresented in a field can feel like there must be a reason why I'm not represented. There must be a reason why I don't see anyone that looks like me or who thinks like me or is attracted to the same person I'm attracted to or whatever. But I would just encourage anyone who's feeling that way to remind themselves that your voice matters, it's important, and it's in fact critical to advancing the way we think about science and the way we think about the world and think about medicine, the way we care for patients. So try not to let it overcome you and keep you from feeling like you should be present at the table, because you should.